Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Pete Musto, Brian Lynn, and Alice Bryant. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Pete Musto.
Statues of historical figures have been the subject of much debate in the United States in recent years. The debate has centered mainly on statues of individuals linked with the Confederacy, the losing side of America's Civil War in the 1860s. Among other things, the Confederacy fought for the right to continue enslaving people with African origins. Now, the state of Maryland has revealed statues of two famous anti-slavery activists, or abolitionists. They are Harriet Tubman and Frederick Douglass. Lawmakers presented the statues to the public during a ceremony Monday night in the Maryland State House. The life-sized statues were dedicated during a special joint session of the Maryland General Assembly in the Old House Chamber. That is the room where lawmakers agreed to end or abolish slavery in the state in 1864. House Speaker Adrian Jones is the state's first black and first female House Speaker. In a prepared speech, she spoke of the importance of Tubman and Douglass and their fight against oppression. The statues are a reminder that our laws aren't always right or just. But there's always room for improvement, Jones said. The statues, dedicated during Black History Month, were made to show Tubman and Douglass as they would have appeared in age and dress in 1864. Both Tubman and Douglass were born on Maryland's eastern shore. Tubman escaped from slavery to become a leading abolitionist. She helped slaves escape using an organized group of anti-slavery activists called the Underground Railroad. Douglass also escaped slavery. He went on to become a writer, speaker, abolitionist, and supporter of women's rights. He wrote and published the story of his life in 1845. It was a bestseller that helped fuel the abolitionist movement. The statues are not the only recent example of the state taking steps to demonstrate its rich black history. Last month, a portrait of a black female former lawmaker took the place of one of a white governor who had been on the wall for 115 years. The painting of Verda Welcome, who was elected to the state Senate in 1962, is the first portrait of a black person on the Maryland Senate's walls. Maryland also has removed painful reminders of its past in recent years. In 2017, the state removed a statue of Roger B. Taney, the U.S. Supreme Court Justice and Maryland native. Taney wrote the 1857 Dred Scott decision that permitted slavery to continue and denied citizenship to African Americans. I'm Pete Musto.
A robot has led human musicians during a live performance in the United Arab Emirates. The robot, called Alter 3, has a human-like face and two long arms. Video from the recent performance in the Emirate of Sharjah showed the machine turning to face orchestra members and waving its arms. Alter 3 even sang at times. The performance was an opera called Scary Beauty, created by Japanese composer Kichiro Shibuya. He told Reuters news agency that the robot acted as the conductor by setting the speed and sound level of the performance. Shibuya said the involvement of robots in the everyday lives of humans is continually increasing. But he said he thinks people will need to decide in the future how artificial intelligence, AI, can best improve the human experience. Shibuya added that he believes humans and robots can learn to work together to create beautiful art. This work is a metaphor of the relations between humans and technology, he said. Shibuya noted that sometimes the music-leading robot can get crazy, making it difficult for the musicians to keep up. But other times the humans and machines cooperate very well. Shibuya said the robots and AI that exist today are far from complete. He is interested in studying how such incomplete technology can be combined with art. From those who witnessed it, the performance drew mixed reactions. "I think this is a very exciting idea. We came to see how it looks like and how much is possible," said Anna Koachevich. Another attendee, who gave his name only as Bilum, said after the show, "You know, a human conductor is so much better." Although he said he is interested in AI and looks forward to big developments, he noted of the project, "The human touch is lost." I'm Brian Lynn.
On a recent Everyday Grammar program, we talked about the phrase, be willing to. For example, you might say, she was willing to travel during the rainy season. The adjective willing belongs to a group of more than 30 adjectives that are followed by infinitive verbs. You probably remember that the infinitive form of a verb is to plus its simplest form. In the sentence about the woman, the infinitive verb is to travel. Adjectives followed by infinitives are the subject of today's Everyday Grammar program. Generally, the adjectives in this group describe a person or people, not a thing. Many of them describe a person's attitude toward or feeling about something. Listen to two sentences and decide which sounds better.
I am happy to see you. I am happy seeing you.
If the first sounds more natural, it is probably because you have heard infinitive verbs after the adjective happy many times in English. In the example, the infinitive is to see. If the second sentence, I am happy seeing you, sounds strange, it is because we don't use gerunds after happy. A gerund is a verb that ends in ing, such as seeing. The grammar of I am happy seeing you is incorrect, but the listener might still understand your meaning. Happy follows the structure be plus adjective plus infinitive. Other adjectives in this group include easy, hard, careful, prepared, good, relieved, and difficult. Next, I have Jill Robbins joining me to demonstrate the grammar with a short exercise. Jill, I'll ask you a question and you answer it using an adjective followed by an infinitive verb. Are you ready?
Yes, I'm ready.
Here's the first one. Crossing busy streets in DC can be dangerous. What are you careful to do before you cross the street?
I am careful to put away my phone before I cross the street. I am also careful to check whether the sign says walk or don't walk.
Good job. You used the adjective careful plus the infinitive verbs to put away and to check in your answer. I noticed you used the adverb also in your second sentence. That's great. Adding an adverb is common in be plus adjective plus infinitive phrases since we often use them to express attitudes and feelings. Let's do another. I noticed that you worked long hours yesterday. When you got home last night, what were you relieved to do?
I was relieved to take off my shoes. I was also relieved to sit down for dinner. Later, I was ready to sleep.
Very good. You used the adjective relieved, followed by the infinitives to take off and to sit down.
And I used the adjective ready, which also belongs to the group of adjectives we're discussing today. I followed it with the infinitive to sleep.
Yes, and you used the past tense of be, which is was. Let's do one more. Some things in life are easy to do, and some are hard to do. What is something that is hard to do?
It is really hard to change a habit.
You're right about that. It is hard to change habits. Jill used the adjective hard, followed by the infinitive verb to change. Notice that she started this sentence with the pronoun it. When we use it in this way, the pronoun is not the true subject of the sentence. The true subject is the infinitive verb, but we do not speak this way. Consider these two examples. Which sounds more natural?
It is hard to change a habit. To change a habit is hard.
The sentence, it is hard to change a habit, sounds more natural, even though the true subject is to change. In English, we rarely begin sentences with infinitive verbs, except in some kinds of writing, such as poetry and other forms of literature. By the way, if we wanted to write the sentence another way, we could replace the infinitive subject to change with the gerund, changing. Then the sentence becomes, changing a habit is hard. And changing is the subject of the sentence. But for today's lesson, What's important is knowing you will see and hear sentences with be plus adjective plus infinitive everywhere. And they sometimes begin with the pronoun it. So, what can you do to practice? Here's one idea. Try to become familiar with the 30-plus adjectives that are followed by infinitives without trying to memorize them. I will provide the list on our website. Then, the next time you hear those adjectives in real life, in a song, on television, or in a movie, listen for the structure we talked about today. Try to make note of the example in your phone or a notebook. You can also practice writing your own sentences and using them when you speak English to friends or practice partners. With time and practice, you will be delighted to use the structure whenever you speak or write English. I'm Alice Bryant.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. Doug Johnson and Shirley Griffith discuss the presidential election of 1920 and the man who won, Warren Harding.
The presidential election of 1920 was a turning point in American politics. It ended a period of social reforms at home and an active foreign policy. It began a period of conservative thinking in both the political and social life of the nation. American reporter H.L. Mencken described the national feeling this way. The majority of Americans are tired of idealism. They want capitalism, openly and without apology.
President Woodrow Wilson had suffered a stroke during his second term. He was very sick. No one expected him to be a candidate again. Yet he refused to announce that he would not run for a third term. Woodrow Wilson had done much during his administration. He helped pass important laws dealing with trade, banking, and the rights of workers. He led the nation through the bloody World War in Europe. He tried, but failed, to have the United States join the new international organization, the League of Nations. The American people honored Wilson for his intelligence and ideas. But they were tired of his policies of social change. And they did not want to be involved in international problems anymore.
The leaders of President Wilson's Democratic Party understood the feelings of the people. They knew they had little chance of winning the presidential election if they nominated a candidate of change. Delegates to the Democratic nominating convention voted 44 times before agreeing on a candidate. They chose the governor of the state of Ohio, James Cox. The Republican Party also had a difficult time at its nominating convention. Four men wanted to be president. The delegates voted six times. None of the men gained enough support, so several party leaders met in private. They agreed that only one man, a compromise candidate, could win the support of the convention. He was a senator from the state of Ohio, Warren Harding. the delegates voted 10 more times before choosing Harding as their candidate for president. For vice president, they chose Calvin Coolidge of Massachusetts.
Warren Harding had owned a newspaper in Ohio. People advised him to enter politics because he was such a good public speaker. During the campaign, he promised lower taxes, less immigration, and more aid to farmers. He called for normalcy, a new period of peace and quiet with few changes. That is what the voters wanted to hear in 1920. Warren Harding won the election with 68% of the popular vote. In his first act as president, he invited people to visit the White House. He permitted them to walk in the garden. The act was a sign. The government seemed to be returning to the people.
Warren Harding is remembered mostly for two events. One was a successful international conference. The other was a shameful national incident. After World War I, Britain, Japan, and the United States expanded their navies. They built bigger and better ships. Many members of the United States Congress worried about the cost. They also worried about increased political tension in Asia. They asked President Harding to organize a conference to discuss these issues.
The conference was held in Washington in November 1921. President Harding invited representatives from the major naval powers of the time, Britain, Japan, France, and Italy. He also invited representatives from countries with interests in Asia, China, Portugal, Belgium, and the Netherlands. He did not invite the new Soviet leaders in Russia. Mr. Harding's Secretary of State, Charles Evans Hughes, spoke. He offered the conference a detailed plan to reduce the size of the world's major navies. He proposed that the world's strongest nations should stop building warships for 10 years. He also proposed that Britain, Japan, and the United States should destroy some ships to make their navies smaller immediately.
Delegates to the conference debated the plan for 3 months. Japan demanded and won the right to have more ships. But the final agreement was very close to the one proposed by Secretary Hughes. The conference was not a complete success. For example, it did not prevent countries from building some kinds of ships. These ships would prove important in the Second World War. Also, it did not create ways to protect China and the islands in the South Pacific Ocean from Japanese expansion. Yet the Naval Treaty of 1921 was the first in which the world's strongest countries agreed to reduce the size of their armed forces. Most people thought it was a good treaty.
The second thing for which President Harding is remembered is the Teapot Dome scandal. It involved the misuse of underground oil owned by the federal government. Warren Harding was an honest man, but he did not have a strong mind of his own. he was easily influenced, and he often accepted bad advice. He explained the problem with these words: I listen to one side, and they seem right. Then I listen to the other side, and they seem just as right. I know that somewhere there is a man who knows the truth, but I do not know where to find him.
President Harding appointed several men of great ability to his cabinet. They included Secretary of State Charles Evans Hughes, Treasury Secretary Andrew Mellon, and Commerce Secretary Herbert Hoover. However, some of his appointments were dishonest men. One was Interior Secretary Albert Fall. He was responsible for the Teapot Dome scandal. Secretary Fall gave a private company the right to take oil from land owned by the federal government. In return, the company gave him money and cattle. The oil was not supposed to be taken from the ground. It was supposed to be saved for the United States Navy to use in an emergency. Private oil companies and many politicians opposed this policy. They said saving the oil was unnecessary.
Albert Fall opposed the policy when he was a member of the Senate. When he became Interior Secretary, his department took control of the lands containing the underground oil. Then he permitted private companies to use the land for a period of time. During that time, the companies could take out the oil. Some of the oil was in the western state of Wyoming. The rock mass on the surface looked like a container for making tea, so the area was called Teapot Dome. When the Senate uncovered Secretary Fall's wrongdoing, the press quickly called the incident the Teapot Dome Scandal. The Senate investigation led to several court cases which lasted throughout the 1920s. Secretary Fall was found guilty of misusing his government position. He was sentenced to prison for 1 year.
President Harding did not live to see the end of the Teapot Dome incident. In the summer of 1923, he made a political trip to Alaska and western states. On the way home, he became sick while in San Francisco. He died of a heart attack. Vice President Calvin Coolidge was in the northeastern state of Vermont when he heard that President Harding had died. Coolidge's father was a local court official there. He gave the oath of office to his son. That is how Calvin Coolidge became the 30th President of the United States.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.
This